even better than the machinery maker, just as the work that we use in the now. So the dust burner has to respond to this, and we are starting to try to hire experts in this field. And I no longer mean lawyers who happen to be versed with computer technology, now are pilots. Pure scientists. So I've appointed the first chief science and technology officer for the Justice Department, who is a professor of computer science at Princeton. We are looking for more PhDs in computer science to help us with this. It's the only way we're going to operate sufficiently to be able to secure the country and to take advantage of the benefits.
AI is an example of something that's relatively new to the department's work. I just wrapped up my third tour of duty in the department. I think this is your fourth tour of duty in the department. When you came back this time, what did you find looked a little bit different than what was the same?
Well, I think what's the same, as you well know, is dedication to career lawyers and the staff of the department doing the right thing, doing it in the right way. To filtering out the noise of Washington and politics and the noise of every district so that we just do what our job is supposed to do. And I'm really proud to find that the problem is still the way it was when I was last there. On the change side, what I found is what really concerns me is the heightened level of threats. And I can see the threats against everyone who works in public spaces, against our judges, against our prosecutors, against our agents, against cops, against local law enforcement, every kind, against election workers. But I don't just mean elected officials and paid officials, but the volunteers who run our elections. Democracy can't succeed and not work if the people who serve to make sure that the civic life goes on are fearful of their lives. But I'm naive. I worked in the Justice Department during some of the worst domestic terrorism attacks that we've ever had, Oklahoma City bombing, Unabomber attack, and Freeman. But what's different now is you see at which these attacks are accelerating, and the speed at which we accelerate from threats to actual kinetic action. That's what worries me. That's why our priority is to fight these attacks. Every day, we have an all-threats meeting at the Justice Department, the FBI, the intelligence agencies, the National Security Division. We call it a scary meeting. And we're just spending the entire day allocating the resources to respond to the kind of threats that we're facing. Domestic terrorism, foreign terrorism, and foreign nation states.
Let me just follow up on some of those high-profile cases that you've been involved in your career. You mentioned Unabomber, you mentioned Oklahoma City. You lived a life responding to some of the most high-profile threats. What lessons did you learn from your involvement in some of those cases, and how do you apply some of those lessons to some of the cases that are of greatest significance right now on January 6th matters?
Well, as you well know, because of your participation in the January 6th investigations, the first point is we know when we have a case of this level of complexity and this level of consequence for the country that we have to get it right. We have to focus our attention on ensuring we get it right. That means, from the very beginning, imagining the mistakes that we could make and making sure that we don't make them because some of them cannot be recovered later. That we think about the entire course, the prosecution, the trial, the appeal, so that we fold in the appellate lawyers at the very beginning of the investigation. We ensure that the archetype of the Justice Department investigation where the prosecutors and the agents are working together actually works, that they're working as a team. So legal and fact development and strategizing and tactics are all worked on from the beginning. That we pressure test at every stage to We run down every lead we can, and if we look like we're in a blind alley, we move into another way to go forward. This is the way we do, we did Oklahoma City, the way we did Unabomber case, the way we did January 6th, and this is the way, in the best circumstances, we do every case in the department.
We all saw that you were down in Selma earlier this week, commemorating the 59th anniversary of Florida Sunday. Why was it important for you to do that?
So I was over the result. But it's done again. And like millions and millions of Americans, I watched Americans, I watched television that night. Nightly news completely devoted to the photo, those horrific meetings. And so on. The marchers were trying to cross the Atlantic. It had such an effect on me, but it also had such an effect on the country. And the galvanized the voting rights movement. And so within 7 months, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in direct response to the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act gave the Justice Department important tools to ensure that every eligible people, that person would have a chance to vote and have their vote counted. And for many years, we used those tools to ensure that. Court decisions, in my view, have weakened our tools. But nonetheless, we feel an obligation to aggressively use the tools we have. We've doubled the size of the voting section of civil rights division in order to move forward. The course of progress in voting rights has never been steady, but every one of us has an obligation to move forward to ensure that the fundamental element of our democracy, the right of people to vote, is ensured. The other side of what's also happening here, and I just alluded to it before, is that people, you know, the attack is not just on voters, it's now on people who facilitate the elections. As I said, it's the election officials, it's the paid voters, and it's the volunteers. And they are not willing to come out and make sure that the elections go forward in a fair way. We're not going to have elections. So it's a major priority of the Justice Department to aggressively pursue the people who are making these threats and obviously the ones who are creating them.
We are all thankful to you for your commitment to protecting civil rights. You have lived a career of tremendous public service, including nearly 25 years in the D.C. Court of Appeals. It's a long time as a judge. What do you miss about it?
Mostly in this judicial meeting. Sometimes I feel like I personally have a different personality. I like the time that I have as a judge to think deeply about the matters. To ensure that we got everything exactly right, that the writing was clear and created respectfully the arguments of the parties. But there's disadvantages to being a judge. It's appropriately so. The passive virtues of the judiciary are that you are not an active, you don't reach out and actively take cases. Take the cases that come up. The cases that come up here come through random number generators. So they may or may not get the case that you want. And with apologies, people are waiting for their opinions to come out. They all take a while. Now, every day, I go to the threats briefing in the morning, or I read the reports from our friends in the press about what Justice Department is doing or what we should be doing. We read it in the morning, leadership came to the firm can do something by the end of the day, or by the end of the week, or to launch an investigation or litigation that gets us there. And that's not something I do as a judge. So, I miss it some, but I'm very happy to have an interest in that.
We're happy to have an interest in that. So, I know a lot of us know about this tradition of there being a portrait done of every attorney general, and then every new attorney general gets to select which of those portraits decorates his or her office during their tenure. I've been in your office a lot of times, so I know what you have on the walls, but could you tell us a little bit about which particular portraits you selected and why?
So I chose four portraits. Really, I like the kind of attorney generals of the 20th century. Began with Robert Jackson, who was FDR's attorney general, and became a justice of the Supreme Court. He made a very famous speech about the role of prosecutors, the proper role of prosecutors. Early on in the first discussions of the fact that we are not just law enforcers, we are also there to provide justice and ensure that when we do bring a case, we treat people fairly. We recognize the enormous consequences of bringing a case against a citizen, for the moral power of the prosecutors, but that has to be contained and explained by the principles of prosecution. I did not imagine that actually what I think turned out to be even more important was when Russia invaded Ukraine. We saw the war crimes that were being committed. We reflected back that one of Jackson's jobs was to be the chief prosecutor in Maryland. So when I was in the beach in Ukraine, we were talking about models of war crime trials, this is the beginning to the four people who were talking to Jackson. Two other important portraits, one Elliot Richardson, who greatly stood for the independence of the Justice Department and his independence in politics during the Watergate era. Ed Leedy was the first post-Watergate Attorney General who really started advancing the norms of the department. The norms of treating life cases alike, the norms of not having different rules, or powerless research for the courts of politics of what we do, which later became encapsulated by the principles of federal prosecution, which were more able to say, yeah, no, and so do all the defense counsels for those who are citing them to us. the department built last but not least, Robert Kennedy, who represents the civil rights mission of the Justice Department, who enormously increased the size of the civil rights division of the department, who fought for civil rights. Throughout his career, particularly in the Justice Department, to make sure that the Justice Department's mission included civil rights. Civil rights was the original formative purpose of the Justice Department. As you know, it was born in 1870 during Reconstruction, with the first principal purpose of protecting blacks who were being attacked by the Ku Klux Klan. And that is a continuing problem of the responsibility of the Justice Department.
Just to follow up on there, everywhere you go, whether you're talking to your component heads, you talk about three co-equal priorities of the department: upholding the rule of law, keeping America safe, protecting civil rights. And I'm still remembering.
Good job.
How does the department's white collar work fit into those three priorities?
Yeah, so obviously, with respect to protection of civil liberties and civil rights during investigations, the rule of law during investigations, I would focus now on the protection of the country and the protection of the economic institutions of the country that make our other institutions more successful possible. The integrity of those economic institutions depend on people believing that everybody is treated equally in the country, that our institutions are not undermined by everything from fraud to insider trading. That damages respect for the economic institutions. But the second element of this is our democratic institutions. If people think that that there is a different rule for the powerful and powerless and the rich and the poor, they lose respect, not only for the Justice Department, for prosecutors, but for the rule of law in the country. And that's why our first priority here at White House Watch is going after individual actors. All of us know that corporations in this room know corporations are actually the acts of corporations are the acts of individuals. All of us in this room, we were in counsel, corporations have an idea that very early on in my career, you know, that the greatest deterrence of white collar crime is the fear of individual prosecutions of executives and companies. But the most important element of this is the rule of law, that people see that if a corporate executive is held to account, is in prison for a corporate crime, that people are being treated equally, that there is a different set of rules, like circumstances that people like. That increases respect for the rule of law. On the contrary, without that, people's respect for the rule of law goes down every level.
So, sir, you did a fantastic job answering all those questions. I'd say the most difficult for my last. We all know that you're a big fan of certain pop stars. If you had to select only one Taylor Swift song to be the theme song, the anthem for the Department of Justice right now, what would you do?
I have the first anthem for this group. Some people maybe have that in their heads, but I'm not sure how many people know. Taylor Swift wrote a song which explained the benefits of telling your white-collar crime to the FBI. That song is On Midnight. It's called Vigilante Something. If you Google it, you'll find out something stands for. So that's your theme song of white-collar crime. No. Yeah. With respect to the Justice Department, and my favorite song is Just Get Off. This is quite a lot to think for all of us in the Justice Department. Shake off the outside attacks. Shake off the little stuff that's going on. You do your job, follow the principles of prosecution, and follow the law.
You have a lot of choices there, bad boy. Well, sir, we are just a couple of days away from your 3-year anniversary as our Attorney General, and we cannot be more honored that you've given your time to be with us today, and the time of a lot of representatives of the department here as well. Just from a personal note, I just have to say it's an honor of a lifetime to serve with you. Ladies and gentlemen, our 86th Attorney General, Merrick Garland.